50.4 trillion rand. That is South Africa's life and disability protection gap. And it's not just this big static number sitting in a ledger somewhere.
No, not at all. It is compounding at 12.5% a year.
Right. Which means it is actively outrunning our ability to fix it.
Right.
You know, every single day, the financial shortfall between what households need if an earner dies or becomes disabled and what they actually have is just getting wider.
It's honestly staggering when you look at it like that.
Okay, let's unpack this, because today we're doing a deep dive into a working paper from September 2026 by Professor Prince Sarpong. It's titled Financial Planning for the Greater Good.
And it's a fascinating read.
It really is. And while this paper centers around a new AI diagnostic tool called SikaSync, I want to be super clear right up front with you. This is not just another tech story about artificial intelligence taking over.
Right, not at all. I mean, it is fundamentally a story about human psychology. It's about how you learn, how you process risk, and, well, why the traditional financial system completely misunderstands you.
Exactly. So the mission of this deep dive is to look at why our standard default approaches to financial literacy are failing spectacularly.
And we are going to explore how shifting our entire perspective, like treating financial risk much more like a routine medical screening, could completely revolutionize our economic well-being.
So if you're listening to this, whether you're a seasoned financial professional trying to reach clients or just someone, you know, trying to figure out your own family safety net, this shift in how we handle risk is going to challenge some of your deepest assumptions today.
It definitely will. I mean, we really have to start by making that 50.4 trillion rand gap feel real, because numbers that large, they just kind of break the human brain.
Yeah, you just can't conceptualize 50 trillion.
You really can't. So let's zoom in a bit. That gap widened by 15 trillion rand in just a three-year window between 2021 and 2024.
15 trillion in 3 years.
Right. And the math behind it is actually pretty simple, though, you know, devastating. The assessed need of households, what they actually require to survive a tragedy, is growing at 9.3%.
But the actual insurance cover is only growing at 5%.
Exactly, which leaves the average earner in South Africa short by about 3.1 million rand.
And that number, that 3.1 million, is crucial because it really highlights the failure of the financial sector's favorite go-to solution. I mean, for decades, whenever the industry sees this gap, they just pour millions into financial education.
Yep. Workshops, seminars, massive literacy campaigns.
Right, which sounds incredibly logical. If people don't have enough insurance, it must be because they don't understand insurance.
Mm.
Teach them, and they'll buy it. But the paper just tears that assumption apart, doesn't it?
Completely tears it apart. I mean, the empirical evidence is, frankly, sobering. The paper points to this massive meta-analysis. We're talking over 200 different studies, and it found that financial education explains only about 0.1% of the variance in downstream financial behavior.
Wait, really? 0.1%? So if I take, like, a six-week literacy course on personal finance, it basically does nothing to change my actual behavior.
It might actually be worse than nothing, because the studies show whatever minimal effect it does have, it decays in less than 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the sector just keeps funding this hypothesis, betting that more education will magically translate into more cover. Meanwhile, the target variable, that massive gap, just keeps deteriorating by the trillions.
Why, though? I mean, it feels so counterintuitive that learning about finance wouldn't actually make you better at finance.
Well, the paper introduces this really elegant philosophical framework to explain it, borrowing from the economist F.A. Hayek.
Okay, what did Hayek say?
So he made a brilliant distinction between two types of knowledge. There's general knowledge and there's local knowledge. Financial education, like those workshops, supplies general knowledge. It teaches you how term life insurance functions, what a premium is, or, you know, the historical returns of the stock market.
Okay, so like the general rules of the game.
Yes, but to make an actual high-stakes insurance decision, general theory is pretty much useless on its own. You need local knowledge.
Right.
You need the highly specific, incredibly messy details of your own life. You need to know your specific mortgage balance, the exact age of your dependents, and that your own personal shortfall is exactly 3.1 million rand.
And a generic literacy course just cannot give you that local knowledge because the educator standing at the front of the room, you know, they don't know your specific particulars.
Exactly. They don't know your life.
I love that framing. It's like the difference between understanding the chemical theory of combustion and knowing that your specific kitchen is currently on fire.
That is a perfect analogy. General knowledge won't save you if you lack the local knowledge that you need a fire extinguisher right this second.
Right. But if education doesn't work, the industry usually just pivots to their second favorite piece of advice, which is just go see a professional financial advisor.
Which introduces an entirely new, massive structural problem.
A huge one. The paper brings in this concept from philosopher C.T. Nguyen called a cognitive island. And I think this is where the traditional industry gets it so wrong.
Oh, the cognitive island is such a great concept.
It really is. Imagine you are stranded on a literal island. You need a boat to leave. But you know absolutely nothing about boat building. Then someone walks up to you and says, "Hey, I'm a master boat builder. Hire me." How do you evaluate them?
You can't. You don't know the difference between good timber and bad timber.
Exactly. Evaluating financial expertise requires you to already have a baseline of financial expertise. If you don't have it, you end up judging the advisor on totally irrelevant things like how nice their suit is, how confident they sound, or, you know, the view from their fancy office.
Yeah, you're just guessing at that point.
Right. So telling an uninsured, overwhelmed consumer to simply go pick a good advisor is asking you to solve the exact problem that made you uninsured in the first place. You are trapped on the cognitive island without a map.
And this is where the dynamic between the industry and the consumer turns actively hostile.
Yeah, it gets really toxic.
Because general education fails, and because people are too intimidated by that cognitive island to seek out generic advice, the industry's reaction is basically to blame the consumer. They stamp the consumer with a very specific, very damaging label. They call them financially illiterate.
Which feels less like a diagnosis and way more like an insult. I mean, nobody wants to be called illiterate. I'll admit it, if I get an email from my bank with a subject line about adjusting my credit facilities, my instinct is to just swipe it into the trash.
Oh, absolutely. It's overwhelming.
It feels intimidating. And the industry's tone often makes you feel like, I don't know, a child who hasn't done their homework.
That psychological reaction you're describing is actually a documented philosophical phenomenon. The paper leans on Miranda Fricker's concept of testimonial injustice, particularly how Boudewijn de Bruin applies it to the financial world.
Testimonial injustice.
Yeah. It's a specific kind of wrong done to someone in their capacity as a knower. When an entire industry repeatedly labels you as financially illiterate, it actively depresses your epistemic self-confidence.
Epistemic self-confidence. So basically, making you doubt your own ability to think clearly.
Precisely. It makes you second-guess your own mind and your own capacity to make sound decisions. The tragedy here is that the label creates a self-sealing loop.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's walk through that loop, because this is where the psychology gets fascinating. The industry shames you with the illiterate label. Your confidence drops. Because you feel intimidated and the cognitive island is terrifying, you avoid the certified professionals. But you still have financial problems that need solving.
Right. You still have the 3 million rand gap.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what do? You narrow your search. You turn to someone you implicitly trust, rather than someone who is qualified.
Yeah, you ask your cousin or a charismatic friend who happens to be pitching, like, a sketchy crypto scheme.
Yes. You take bad advice from an unqualified source because they don't make you feel stupid. Predictably, the advice blows up, you lose money, you remain underinsured, and then the formal industry looks at the smoldering wreckage of your finances and says, see, we told you they were financially illiterate.
It's terrible, and it becomes impossible to break the cycle because the cure the industry offers, more financial education, is delivered in the very same register that caused the harm. It feels like a lecture highlighting your deficits. It just reinforces the shame.
So we have to abandon the schooling model. We definitely have to stop shaming people. What is the alternative? How do we actually fix a compounding 50 trillion rand problem if we can't teach our way out of it?
Well, we look to a field that has successfully solved this exact type of problem. Public health.
Oh, the medical model.
Yes. When the medical field wants to change outcomes across a population for a disease that is asymptomatic but catastrophic, think about HIV or cervical cancer.
Yeah.
They do not run public lecture series on the intricacies of immunology.
Right. They don't try to make you medically literate enough to, like, diagnose your own white blood cell count.
No. They screen. They deploy a cheap, standardized test that takes an invisible risk and makes it instantly visible for the individual. Then they refer that patient to care.
Which makes perfect sense.
And financial underinsurance has the exact same structure as an asymptomatic disease. It is completely invisible on a Tuesday. It causes zero pain right up until the day a tragedy happens. And then it is catastrophic when realized.
Which brings us to the instrument the paper proposes, Sikasync. This is the medical screening, but for your finances.
Exactly. It's a free, non-advisory diagnostic tool.
You input your specific life details, and it acts like a financial MRI. It doesn't give you theory, it gives you your local knowledge. It returns the exact RAND shortfall for your specific household.
Yeah.
But the paper makes a really subtle distinction here. It says Sikasync asks to be read, not believed. What does that mean in practice?
Well, think about how we usually interact with technology, particularly, you know, robo-advisors. Most of them are recommendation engines. They digest your data and then tell you what to do. They say, buy this fund or adjust this portfolio.
Right.
Accepting their output requires you to blindly extend trust to a machine, which is inherently paternalistic. It's like a bossy robot.
Yeah, it makes the decision for you.
But a diagnostic tool is different. It is simply a measurement device, much like a thermometer. It gives you a measurement of your own position based purely on the inputs you provided. It changes the evidence you have in front of you, but it hands the deliberation right back to you.
So it says, here is your exact temperature. You decide if you need to put on a coat.
Exactly. It preserves your autonomy.
And behaviorally, getting that specific number triggers a very different psychological response than getting a lecture. The paper cites research by John Grable on what actually motivates people to seek financial help. The tool has to engineer a state the paper calls salience without shame.
Grable's research is absolutely key here. He found that people who actually go out and engage a financial advisor exhibit a very specific dual psychological state. They have moderate to high physiological arousal, meaning like a sense of urgency, a feeling that this is a highly salient issue. But crucially, they have very low financial anxiety.
Wait, if you tell someone they are 3 million rand in the hole, isn't that immediately going to spike their anxiety and just paralyze them?
You'd think so, but it depends entirely on the framing. People who do not engage advisors exhibit the opposite state, low arousal and high anxiety. They avoid the topic because it causes dread, which leads to self-imposed helplessness.
So if a billboard tells you, hey, South Africans are drastically underinsured, you are being irresponsible, that causes shame and anxiety, but it's not specific enough to create action.
Exactly. But if a tool quietly calculates your numbers and says, without any judgment, based on your mortgage and two kids, your family has a 3.1 million rand gap. Here are three steps you can take today.
That raises the urgency, the salience, but strips away the moralizing, judgmental language. The shame stays low.
Precisely. Salience without shame. You now have the boat to get off the cognitive island.
Okay, I want to push back on the technology itself for a second. If this is just a matter of running personal numbers to give a diagnostic shortfall, why hasn't AI already solved this? I mean, we are swimming in AI right now.
We are, but it's being used for the wrong things.
Right. The paper even cites a late 2024 survey from the Financial Planning Standards Board. Financial planners use AI heavily. The survey shows they use it for drafting client emails. About 41% do that, and for marketing, around 35%. But using AI for actual insurance needs analysis, only 14%. Why are they using this supposedly world-changing tech to write polite newsletters instead of closing a 50 trillion rand gap?
Because of the limitations of the technology itself. The general purpose large language models that everyone is familiar with, like ChatGPT, they're built by software engineers, not financial planners.
Good point.
They are incredibly good at predicting the next word in a sentence, which makes them great at writing a newsletter, but they lack deep structural domain knowledge.
So if I ask a generic AI to calculate my life insurance needs, what happens?
It will hallucinate. It might confidently tell you that your life insurance policy will pay off your house, but it doesn't know the nuances of South African estate law. It doesn't know which of your liabilities survive your death, or that the bank might have first dibs on certain assets.
It's just guessing elegantly.
Exactly. It doesn't factor in what your specific employer benefits already cover or how estate duty is calculated. Sikasync works because it abandons the generative AI approach for the actual math. It embeds that deep specific domain knowledge into a deterministic calculation engine. It doesn't guess, it calculates.
Okay, so the consumer takes the test, they get their local knowledge, they have their specific shortfall number, completely devoid of shame. They are ready to act and hire a practitioner. But if we suddenly have a massive wave of people looking for help, who is catching that demand?
That is the million-dollar question.
Because the paper highlights a glaring structural problem with distribution in South Africa. I want to read a quote from Jeanette Moraes, the group CEO of Momentum Metropolitan Holdings.
Oh, this quote is so telling.
She pointed out that 85% of South African personal income taxpayers are Black, Indian, or colored. Yet she says there is, quote, not one large black financial advisor firm or advisor group in SA.
She framed that as an opportunity, but the paper rightly diagnoses it as a profound structural barrier. I mean, for 7 years, the financial industry has run enterprise development programs trying to fix this imbalance. They wanted to create these large black-owned firms, and they failed.
But why? If you have corporate backing and funding, how do you fail?
Because of what those programs actually supplied. They provided capital to rent office space. They provided skills training. They provided compliance infrastructure. But they missed the single most important ingredient for any business.
Which is clients.
Clients. You can have the most qualified, compliant micropractice in the country. But if client acquisition is prohibitively expensive, the business will starve.
Right. If you are fighting over the tiny 9% of households that currently use a financial advisor, you are bleeding money on marketing just to get a single meeting.
Exactly.
But this diagnostic tool flips the funnel. By screening the other 91% of people who were previously ignored, it generates a massive, unprecedented pipeline of qualified demand.
And has
a matching engine built in, right?
Yes. Once you get your number, it pairs you with 5 vetted advisors. And here's the brilliant part. You, the user, get to choose the dimensions that matter to you. You can filter by language, faith, race, or even specific lived experiences.
Wow. So it's not just a random assignment.
No, this taps into a powerful behavioral driver called homophily. The paper cites a study by Stolper and Walter called Birds of a Feather. It proves empirically what we all intuitively know. People are significantly more likely to follow through on financial advice when they feel a deep affinity or similarity with their advisor.
It goes back to trusting someone who understands your context. If I am dealing with the pressures of, say, black tax-supporting extended family members while trying to build my own wealth, or if I'm a first-generation professional navigating corporate wealth for the first time, I want an advisor who doesn't just understand the math, but understands my life.
Exactly. And the beauty of this matching engine is how it solves the structural barrier without forcing anything. If you open up a marketplace of vetted practitioners to a population that is overwhelmingly black, and you simply allow them to choose who they trust based on their own elective preferences,
the transformation happens naturally. There is no forced political quota. It is purely mathematics and human preference working in tandem.
Yes.
You empower the consumer to choose, and the demand naturally flows to these subscale black-owned practices. It provides them with the exact lifeblood they need to grow from a solo operation into a large, sustainable firm, which is a steady stream of clients.
It uses the distribution of advice as a mechanism for capital formation. It really solves 2 massive problems at once.
Okay, let's talk economics, because everything you've described sounds incredibly expensive to build and run. If this diagnostic tool is completely free for the consumer to use, how does the ecosystem survive? It can't just be a giant charity project.
No, it operates on a token model based on a very simple economic principle. The party that benefits from the downstream value is the one who funds the stan.
Let's follow the money there. Who is buying the tokens?
Institutional providers, for one. An insurance company can buy tokens to route matches exclusively to their own tied network of advisors. Development funds can buy tokens to sponsor scans, specifically routing the resulting matches to qualifying black-owned practices to actively drive that structural transformation we just talked about.
Oh, that's clever.
Right. Or an individual advisor can simply buy tokens themselves, because the cost of a token is a highly efficient client acquisition cost compared to running expensive marketing campaigns.
And the unit economics they modeled are staggering. Even if we use a highly conservative estimate, let's say only 10% of the people who take the scan actually convert into buying a policy. Over 5 years, this system would place nearly 1 trillion rand, 0.98 trillion of new cover into force.
Yep.
And for a network of, say, 500 practices catching that demand, it generates 12.85 million rand in gross revenue per practice.
That is the difference between a struggling solo act and a real durable institution.
Absolutely. But to truly understand where all this hidden demand is coming from, we have to look at a massive blind spot the paper addresses, which is the public sector. Specifically, they look at the Government Employees Pension Fund, the GEPF.
Oh, this part is so crucial.
This fund has over 1.27 million active members. We are talking about teachers, nurses, police officers, middle-income earners with stable jobs. Most of them assume they are perfectly covered because the fund includes a death gratuity. But the paper points out a tragic timing mismatch.
The timing mismatch is perhaps the most insidious part of the protection gap. The death benefit provided by the GEPF scales directly with your years of service. So logically, the payout peaks very late in your career when you've been working for 30 years.
But think about the timeline of like a typical 32-year-old math teacher. She just bought a house, so she has a massive new bond. She just had a baby, so she has decades of educational expenses ahead of her. Her financial obligations peak early in her life.
Yes, exactly when her coverage is lowest.
Right. If she has 10 years of service, her death gratuity might pay out, what, around 843,000 Rand?
Yeah.
But the average gap she is actually facing to protect that house and that child is 3.1 million.
She is living under an illusion of coverage because that pension benefit is automatic. It's always deducted from her paycheck without her ever having to price it or choose it. It crowds out her desire to buy supplemental insurance. She mistakes the fact that she has cover with the assumption that she is fully covered.
It's like carrying an umbrella that only opens all the way once the storm is practically over. You walk outside thinking you're protected from the rain, but when the downpour hits early in your career, you are getting completely soaked.
That analogy is spot on, and because there is no mandate forcing anyone to run the arithmetic and show that young teacher her specific shortfall, the gap just persists invisibly.
Which is why the diagnostic screening is so vital.
Exactly. It performs the harsh arithmetic that currently sits in the blind spot between institutional benefits and retail needs.
So what does this all mean? We started with an unthinkably large number, a 50.4 trillion rand gap. What Professor Sarpong's paper masterfully argues is that this gap is not a failure of intelligence. It is an epistemic failure.
Absolutely.
It is a failure of how the industry delivers knowledge and how consumers are allowed to understand it. By swapping shame for medical-style screening and by replacing generic schooling with a simple, highly legible diagnostic, the power shifts entirely back to you, the consumer. You get your specific number, you build your boat to get off the cognitive island, and you get to choose an expert whose lived experience you actually relate to.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this working paper isn't just a manual for closing an insurance gap in South Africa. It serves as a profound blueprint for how society should be thinking about the role of artificial intelligence.
How so?
Well, we can choose to use AI to build systems that act as mirrors, reflecting our own complex, messy realities back to us with absolute clarity so we can make our own better decisions. We don't have to use AI as an oracle that just paternalistically dictates what we should do. This is fundamentally about using technology to preserve and enhance human autonomy.
It's a total shift in respect for the consumer. It treats you like an adult capable of making choices once you have the right evidence.
It really does. However, I do want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought, which is drawn straight from the paper section on long-term risks.
Yeah, lay it on us.
The author warns of a future phenomenon called epistemic dependency. If we increasingly rely on perfectly calibrated AI diagnostics to point out every single one of our financial, health, and personal blind spots, do we risk losing the internal cognitive muscle required to sense our own vulnerabilities out in the wild?
The wow.
Right. If a machine is always there to tap us on the shoulder and tell us exactly where we are exposed, do we eventually forget how to look for the risks ourselves? It is a fascinating tension and something for you to carefully consider the next time a brilliant piece of technology tells you exactly what you need.